So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety.
Welcome to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and I am your host for the day, David Hampton, and Nate Larkin, my co-host, is off in the hills of North or South Dakota. I can't really remember. It doesn't really matter, Rex, because we're not there. And we are here, and Nate is cool and wearing a jacket somewhere, and we are still sweating in what we call post-summer, pre-fall, or actually in Nashville, we call fall summer with pumpkins. So that's really all it is. We have two seasons here, hot, and then about 4 weeks of cold, and then we're hot again. But no, it's great that Nate is off speaking and leading a conference and doing his thing that he does so well, and we miss him, but we are going to trudge along today without him. And you know, it's been an interesting couple of weeks for me, because I have had the opportunity at my church. I attend St. Augustine's Episcopal Church that meets on Vanderbilt campus here in the greater Nashville area. And my church is doing an adult forum series right now on 12-step spirituality for people who may not necessarily consider themselves addicts or in compulsive behavioral disorders, but that want to incorporate the 12 steps into their lives. And so my friend Ian Cron, you know Ian from being a guest here. You also know him from his book, The Road Back to You, and the Enneagram work that he does. And Ian is a great, great friend of mine. And he's also sort of an associate priest at my church. And Ian invited me to teach some of the classes. And so I've had an opportunity the last couple of weeks to teach on 12-step spirituality for our everyday lives. And it's really been a great exercise for me to take what I thought I already knew about 12-step recovery and put it in a vernacular that people who don't experience the 12-step meetings or haven't been to rehab or deal with addiction as a day-to-day besetting problem in their lives, it's helped me really have to think hard about the words I use and the way I present something. And so the first step, of course, I got to talk about surrender. And I realized that so much of the time we talk about surrendering our behavior as a first step. You know, we talk about surrendering your powerlessness over your substance, over your compulsion, sexual compulsions or other compulsions, and we think we're surrendering alcohol, or we're surrendering our behavior, our relationship to that substance with which we are powerless. But what I'm realizing is surrender is really us letting go of the reasons that we drank in the first place, or that we act out in the first place. Things like our entitlement, our resentment, our belief that if I don't engage in this, I won't be fulfilled, or I may die. I may actually not, I may cease to be. And the broken beliefs that we have about our lives and about ourselves and about God and the world around us, the narrative that plays in our heads, all those things are actually what we have to begin to surrender and believe that we can be okay apart from. And then we begin to experience surrendering the behavior or our relationship to the substance or whatever that is. But it's been a really great experience just taking 12-step principles and reframing them in language that we get so used to using among one another that for someone outside of our circles may not have a category for. And it's been really, really an awesome experience to hear how people are impacted by this ideology when they can actually take it out and apply it themselves. And so I would encourage you, listeners, maybe as a kind of a daring experiment in your circles, wherever you find yourselves, maybe try a study with some folks, a home study or a group, or if you're part of a faith community that might be open to experimenting with that. Talk about what 12-step recovery, 12-step spirituality really looks like apart from just an addiction model, and see where it takes you, because it really opens up a lot of discussion about our truth, our lives, the narratives that we have all bought into, regardless of where we consider ourselves on the spectrum of addiction. And so I just wanted to share that with you. That's kind of my little free, for what it's worth, takeaway for the day. But I want you guys to stay with us, because I've got a really great guest today who has taken some really bold and interesting steps toward his own personal recovery and incorporated some things that are going to benefit all of us if we dare take it on. But I want you to just stay with us. I don't even want to give you more information yet. I want you to stay with us and take a good listen to this guest. And I think you may find yourself wanting to get in touch with him and explore his information, because he's got some really good challenges for all of us in a way to approach our own personal recovery that will affect us physically and give us a lot of physical benefits and psychological benefits that will take us even beyond just our own personal recovery practices. So stay where you are. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and I am so glad to have our guest with us today, Mr. Chris Scott. And Chris is the author of a book called Drinking Sucks, which I love the title, and he is the founder and creator of a program called FitRecovery.com, and a co-host of a podcast called Elevation Recovery that he shares with someone else that he's going to tell us all about. And Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, David. It's wonderful to be here. And I should just clarify, it's fit-recovery.com.
Fit-recovery.
I couldn't quite afford to buy the fitrecovery.com when I started it.
Okay. There you go. So fit-recovery.com. Thank you. Yeah, that's important. And well, given the title here, you know, Chris takes a little bit of a specific approach toward recovery, as you might guess from the title of your program. So with fitness, nutrition, and some of the things that you know from that world and that you've brought into your own recovery, and that's what we love to do here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast, is talk about ways that people have found that out of their own story work for them uniquely and that they're sharing with other people. But Chris, you have a recovery story of your own. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got here?
Yeah, absolutely. So I got hooked on alcohol pretty young. You know, I was one of those almost stereotypical cases of the first time you drank, you couldn't stop drinking. And so that was a harbinger of things to come later on. And, you know, despite that, though, I was always very high functional. I got very good grades. I went to a elite college, liberal arts school in the Northeast. And there was no evidence that I had that my drinking was harming me for a long time. I mean, not really until I got out into the work world. I worked in investment banking after college. That's not the best place to go in terms of industry if you have a drinking problem, because there's plenty of opportunity, you know, bottle service on Tuesday for no reason because your boss wants you there. So for me, the physical dependence came first. Mm-hmm. And I'd done every now and then when I would be a little bit honest with myself, I would look into alcoholism or maybe Google alcohol addiction and wonder, maybe that's what's going on with me. Although I could string together until the very end, I could string together maybe 5 or 7 days of sobriety. But I would look that up and I'd think, well, you know, it seems that this is a spiritual disease and it must be rooted in my childhood. And I'd had a stellar childhood. I was adopted, but I was adopted at the age of 6 weeks. I had wonderful parents, a great family, no abuse, thank God. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't pinpoint it on anything. And I just figured, well, for me, it's not that I'm drinking to cover up pain. It's that I feel like an 8 out of 10 most of the time, but I'm drinking because when I drink, I get like 12 out of 10. You know, I remember going out in my balcony once in college. I think it was my junior year of college, the summer between junior and senior year. I had an internship at a glamorous place in New York. And I thought, this is great, but I have my gin and tonic now, which I'd made at about 4 in the afternoon. And I thought to myself, why don't people drink all the time? Like, why wouldn't you want to feel like this all the time? I don't get it. Why aren't people drinking at breakfast, lunch, and dinner? So, you know, obviously I'm not closed to the idea that there could be hidden, trauma or, you know, micro traumas. I think everyone who's alive is traumatized to some degree. Right. So I could have been covering up, but who knows? For me, it seemed primarily biochemical. And to make a long story a little bit shorter, after about 10 years of my addiction, so well into my 20s, but after I'd started in the work world, things started to get really bad. And it was like a roller coaster. It was just a vicious cycle of relapse and drinking and withdrawal. And I definitely experienced something called kindling, by which your withdrawal symptoms get worse every single time to the point where I was having hallucinations. And I'm pretty sure I had some mini seizures in my apartment alone. And it got to the point where I missed 3 days of work in a row because I couldn't leave my apartment without drinking in the morning. And I gave up at that point. And after that third day, I had a BlackBerry at the time. My boss is sending me emails like, where are you? What's going on? And I just threw my hands up. And I guess you could say I surrendered. I called my parents. I called like my 5 or 6 closest friends. Mm-hmm. Had heart to hearts with them. That's probably one of the best things I did in retrospect.
Yeah.
Because I sure didn't have any of the strategies I have now.
Yeah.
But still, social support is just so important. And then I ended up going to detox professionally, and I spent some time in inpatient rehab. And then that was the kind of inflection point where I definitely benefited from going away for a while, but I realized that I had a different approach. And the way I characterize it now is that there were some missing links that, at least for me, and apparently for other people, are not addressed by the mainstream rehab programs out there, the Minnesota model. And it's not necessarily the 12 steps. That might be part of it, but it's more of a closed-mindedness towards some of these alternative strategies that can really help, nutrition being one of those for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And when you say the Minnesota model, you're talking about like the Hazelden groups and things like that. We're not pointing fingers and throwing rocks at all, but there is a particular modality that has up to now and recently become the flagship model for treatment. And,
exactly. Yeah. In the same way that I think if you had any illness and there was only one method of one drug that was prescribed, but we had evidence that were that there were like 15 different ways that could help people depending on their biochemical and psychological uniqueness or individuality. Yeah. You wouldn't be throwing rocks at the drug that's helping some people, but you would question the system a little bit.
Right. We had a guest recently who's a guy that is a colleague friend of mine, Dr. Stephen Lloyd, and he was on several episodes ago. And one of the things that's unique about Dr. Lloyd is he was at one time the director of the Department of Mental Health for the state of Tennessee. And he also is a recovering opioid addict. That he developed that disorder as a physician. But he's now a medical director at one of the treatment centers that I refer to here in the greater Nashville area as one of the things that he does. All that is to set up the point that he made on the podcast on his episode that said that, and it stuck with me. He said, addiction is one of the only things where if our one modality of treatment doesn't work, we blame the patient. You know, if you had diabetes and you did not respond to this type of insulin or this type of program, this type of thing, we would change how we approach it. We would go to this type of thing, or we would ask you to embrace these types of things or changes. And, you know, we had cancer, these types of things don't impact that person. Maybe this will, and we take that, but we don't sit the patient down and blame the patient. But in addiction, we do, right. Or we tend to.
Yeah, I think it's because addiction is so complex, and it's one of the only conditions, certainly not the only, because you have schizophrenia and other mental disorders that may have a physiological component, but it's one of the only big ones that hijacks free will. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of inextricable from behavior, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult to pinpoint whether a person is choosing to do something or whether they're compelled to do it, because we have no tangible way to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so because I've got a lot of questions about, because the idea of fitness and recovery is really something I'm very interested in, because we're learning so much about the importance of even, you know, people experiencing the endorphins that they need from exercise and from activity and things like that. So how did you make the connection between, okay, I've gone to treatment, I did my, you know, check that box, I did the deal the way I'm supposed to, and, you know, on paper, I've fulfilled my obligation to sobriety, and I've gone to treatment, but there's got to be another way that's going to work for me better. How did you make that recognition that you needed to incorporate fitness, and why fitness and why not, you know, pottery?
Right. Yeah. Well, for some people, I think it could be pottery.
And it could be.
But for me, it was fitness. And I kind of fell into that by accident. Or you could say by my own vanity. I wanted my physique to be a symbol of my victory over alcohol addiction. And okay. Not for Instagram. And, you know, Instagram, honestly, is something I still struggle with. I don't fit into that world. I forget to post. But it was just for me. You know, mm-hmm. I wanted to look in the mirror when I woke up and feel strong and look strong. And, as a symbol of my competence, as a symbol of my victory. Mm-hmm. And so I started hitting the gym when I was still in inpatient rehab. And I wasn't doing very impressive workouts, but I was doing what I could. You know, I was on a benzodiazepine taper for a while, a little bit loopy, mm-hmm. but I started gradually ramping it up. And I'd always been into fitness. I'd been an athlete my whole life. And it, you know, the last 3 years or so of my alcohol addiction, my fitness level just went down all, you know, to zero right. practically. So yeah. It was a process of rebuilding, but I noticed that I felt way better after my workouts without any alcohol in my system than I had back when I drank. It was like working out was something that I wanted to do it when I was mm-hmm. drinking, but I didn't actually want to do it. It was a chore. It was an obligation. But after I quit, after I excised the alcohol from my life, the workouts became my new dopamine rush. And this was actually a point of conflict with some of the more dogmatic counselors at the rehab, because they were saying that that exercise was an addictive drug and I needed to not do it because I would get cross-addicted and it would inevitably lead me back to alcohol.
You were just replacing one addiction
exactly.
for another. And, yeah.
And then I thought, well, yes, but I mean, are there not, or if the definition of addiction is negative consequences, then I need to figure out what exactly the consequences are of me working out. And I found out that obviously there could be someone who runs on the treadmill for 10 hours a day. I haven't met them, but I guess exercise addiction is a thing. Mm-hmm. But the consequences for me, as I've researched it, were, as you said, replenishment of endorphins, like restoring color to at least part of your day in that several hours after the workout and during the workout, better mental clarity, higher levels of BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which can facilitate neuroplasticity. So you're rewiring your brain more quickly. It helps with cravings, and you're really getting a cascade, a natural cascade of all of those neurotransmitters, including serotonin, norepinephrine, GABA, that you relied on alcohol for. So now you have an alternative. So the way I viewed it was, at least in retrospect, I was building a new neural pathway that competed for attention with the drinking one. And eventually, since neurons that don't wire, neurons that fire together, wire together, and neurons that don't fire die, I hastened the dissolution of the drinking neural pathway. And suddenly, oh no, I have to work out every day. But then I actually got to the point, because that wasn't my only strategy. You know, I had meditation and nutrition, better sleep was huge, which is also furthered by exercise. I developed a balance of things that helped me not have any one thing emerge in the same, I guess, enormity as alcohol had in my life. So exercise is very much in check for me, as it is for most people that I find who turn to it after conquering the initial phase of addiction.
Right. And so, Chris, how do you convince, I use that word for lack of a better one, persuade maybe is a better word, a client or someone who comes to you who says, you know, either I'm newly sober or I'm trying to get or stay sober. What you're saying sounds good to me, but I'm not the gym type. I'm not a runner. I'm not a guy that works out. I'm not comfortable in that. You know, how do you get people over that hump to believe that this is even a possibility in their life when they've maybe never even experienced themselves in that way prior?
I'm glad you asked that, because I think that before someone can start using exercise as a healthy replacement for drinking, and that might not be the best way to characterize it, but before they can really integrate exercise into their new life, I think that there's a lot of repair that they have to do first. So it's not the case that I'm talking to people typically who are still drinking and I'm just trying to get them to go to the gym. Obviously, some people have to professionally detox. And then there's that post-acute withdrawal phase where you're right, people do have a reluctance to go to the gym. But I think that what has to precede the exercise and exerting yourself is fixing your nutrition. And that can start with diet, obviously rehydrating yourself if you've recently quit drinking. And for me, supplementation. And a lot of people find that when they infuse themselves with the nutrients that alcohol was flushing out as a diuretic and also inhibiting because it's so bad for gut health, once they replace those nutrients and they give themselves the raw materials for neurotransmitters and feel-good hormones and just rejuvenation, then they start to naturally have higher energy levels. And that internal fire that you need to go to the gym starts coming back. So I found that the nutrition component, that puzzle piece fits in really before the exercise. I do think that people can benefit from getting a sweat in, you know, maybe just like 10 minutes on the elliptical, even if they're still in like, you know, a week or two after detox, but depending on how severe their addiction was. I mean, I'm assuming that was for me, and I was drinking nearly a handle of vodka a day before I quit. So, for me, it was several weeks. I couldn't go slam weights at the gym.
Right.
And I actually discovered the supplementation by mistake as well, because I was taking a very strong multivitamin. a B vitamin complex, fish oil, and L-glutamine. I was taking the L-glutamine for muscle growth, but I noticed that my cravings for alcohol were going away. And so it turns out there's a large body of research that most doctors aren't familiar with. Dr. Kenneth Blum, Joan Matthews Larson wrote a book called 7 Weeks to Sobriety about the nutritional aspect. There's all of these, and Julia Ross, who we actually recently had on our podcast, is a pioneer in the use of amino acids for mood disorders. And so I had kind of stumbled across those nutrients as an attempt first just to build some muscle. And then I realized, wow, there's a whole other universe here. And so, sorry, the short answer to your question is, if people can't go to the gym or don't want to, I find it best to work on building them up from scratch. So there's more basic levels, nutrition being one of them, I found is key.
Yeah. And maybe reality for somebody is a 20-minute walk.
Yeah, totally.
At the beginning, you know, I guess.
I think walking is underrated.
Well, yeah, because, right, you get a, I mean, especially if you're a person that's been sedentary for so long, and especially with, you know, alcohol abuse, you know, it's hard to be really, it's hard to be really active and drink a handle of vodka a day, right? So you're not, you know, probably setting land speed records at that point. So maybe a 20-minute walk is the launch place. You mentioned vitamin B, and I've had other people that have talked to me about that. Can you tell me a little bit about the importance of that in repairing your brain, neuropathways, and things like that?
Yeah, so B vitamins are some of the cofactors for the synthesis of neurotransmitters. And there's a lot that they do. I mean, people associate B vitamins with energy. You know, you go to a doctor, get a shot of vitamin B12, and you feel like a different person. You know, there's something called the Myers cocktail, where people go to these nutritional IV centers and they get, I think it's magnesium, vitamin C, and B12, maybe something else, and they just feel great. But if you have, let's say, delirium tremens, or you're having seizures, and you go to the hospital, they will give you withdrawal meds, but they'll also give you a shot of thiamine, which is vitamin B1. And that's super important, because without that, you can end up with a situation called wet brain, which is, you know, potentially not reversible. And it's just, you know, you're in a very bad spot. You can't really function mentally for the rest of your life. So B vitamins are just very, they're flushed out by alcohol, and progressively so over time. And you can get them from food, but most people have found that in order to restore their energy levels, in order to restore their we'll say, feel-good chemicals, the neurotransmitters, dopamine, GABA is a huge one. GABA is the primary calming neurotransmitter. There are various intricate ways in which B vitamins and other basic vitamins and minerals help to support the regeneration and replenishment of these chemicals that we need to feel like our life has color again.
Yeah.
So I often say that when I quit drinking for a period of time, until I found B vitamins and a range of other basic nutrients. I mean, we're talking things you can get at CVS or Amazon. These aren't really, or at least most of them, they're not, you know, exotic things, but a lot of people just don't know about them. But until I discovered B vitamins and these other compounds, I felt like I was in a kind of black and white, fragile world.
Yeah. Yeah. And so how long into your, when you launched into your own fitness approach to all this, with all this, how long before you began to notice a change in your mental acuity, your clarity, your disposition, your problem solving skills, all these, you know, executive functions of your brain, all this coming back to you? You know, obviously it's not, you know, overnight, but give us an idea of like what people might anticipate.
Right. I think it really depends on how much you drank and for how long you drank. So for someone who has been having 4 glasses of wine a night for a year, they might not relate to my, the severity of my situation. But for me, I was really loopy for a while. Probably the first month after I quit drinking was really hazy. For about 10 days of that, I was on a benzodiazepine called Ativan. So I remember almost nothing. was just basically, I was not having seizures or hallucinations is what I was doing at that point. Mm-hmm. And after that, I felt a sense of stability and relief, but I didn't feel like joy, happiness, intense emotion. Yeah. I felt very muted for a while. And I was grateful for the stability and relief, but I knew that to make the rest of my recovery and the rest of my life sustainable, I would have to find a way to feel actual joy, actual euphoria, and to not feel it from alcohol. And it took months of white knuckling. I discovered some of the supplements that I characterized as the raw materials for getting those feel-good chemicals back in my brain. Some of them I did discover when I was in inpatient rehab, but many of them, some of the amino acids, which I think are so important, I didn't discover those until all of those until like 6 to 8 months after I quit drinking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by then I was still struggling with anxiety attacks, not every day, but they would kind of come and go and I had no idea what was causing them. It really wasn't until probably 8 months to a year that I started feeling really stable. And that's because I suspect I had the nutritional pillar in place, but I'd also read some Tony Robbins, NLP. I started to take control of my perspective of alcohol and drinking culture specifically. Mm-hmm. I made a conscious decision not to live in a state of deprivation. Yeah. And I realized that we have more control over our beliefs than we think. And that even though I was so focused on the biochemical pillar of recovery, the psychological pillar affects the biochemistry as well. You know, if you can reframe something successfully, then you're changing the wiring in your brain, even if you can't see it. So that for me really helped me get to the point where I was living in full color again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so that brings me to a point of some of this comes down to your belief system in some way, right? I mean,
yeah, definitely. So I remember before I quit drinking, about 2 months before, I'd gone to a therapist who's a really nice guy, a good guy. I think he was a little overwhelmed with my situation because I would walk in clearly having ripped a few shots that morning and he didn't know what to do with me, but he was trying to get me to picture happiness without alcohol. And he said, so picture yourself on a cruise, just out, you know, no work stress, none of these other things that at the time I was rationalizing my drinking with. And he said, picture yourself on a cruise and you're with your family and your close friends and there's no alcohol. And I said, too late. I already pictured the champagne glasses clinking when you said the word cruise. You know? And so, and that could have been, I mean, part of that was that I believed firmly that all pleasure and joy and good things in the world came from alcohol.
Yeah.
And I never really pressed myself on that belief, but I just assumed it. And the farther I fell into the rabbit hole of alcohol addiction, the more it became just an assumption for me. You know, like, oh, we have a snow day from work. Well, obviously everyone's going to drink. You know, like I got my friends used to say, like, you think that just that people are drinking just because it's raining outside, like, because I was drinking. So I'm like, why aren't you guys drinking? So yeah, I think beliefs play a huge role. It's these subconscious, unchecked, unverified beliefs that we have that we cling onto that serve as rationalization agents for continuing to do something. But if we really take the time to sit down and we're willing to experience the pain of obliterating these assumptions, then we can change our behavior for sure. I think that goes hand in hand with the physiological component.
Yeah.
So, you know, drinking culture was something that I had to take particular aim at after I quit drinking. And because I did, you know, I said I felt the relief and stability of getting rid of the alcohol. But I went to a wedding about two months after I quit drinking. And it was a bit early for me psychologically because I realized I really wanted to do tequila shots with my friends. I was sitting alone at my table, looking at the duck or whatever we'd been served, poking at it. All my friends from college are lined up, like 15 of them, doing shots and turning around and looking at me. You know, and not in a like a not in a judgy way. And they all supported me. And honestly, if I'd gone and said, "Hey, give me a shot," they wouldn't have let me do it. But it was still like, "What do I do with this situation? And what am I supposed to believe about it?" So eventually, I crafted a belief which I still have today, which is that drinking is the poison that apparently other people need to get on my level. And that's a bit arrogant, but it works for me. I think of myself as a little bit enlightened. My friends think it's funny, and honestly, my friends who still drink, and I don't have any heavy drinking friends, but I have social drinking friends, social drinking family members who occasionally binge, and they text me in the morning now after a binge, after they go to a wedding or a work event, and they drink regretfully much, and they say, "Chris, you're right. Drinking sucks. What am I doing? You know, you had it right." so now I get all of this reference evidence for my new belief.
Yeah. Well, and so drinking sucks being the name of your it's an ebook, right?
Yeah, there's a paperback on Amazon as well.
Okay. So tell me about Drinking Sucks. Tell me at the book. So how's that? I mean, I guess it could have come about from your conversations with your friends that say drinking sucks and your own experience, but
That's good. That's a good guess, because it's true. I actually named it Drinking Sucks because after one of those binges that my friends had, who we would call a social drinker, they just typed "Drinking sucks. I'm never drinking again." Like, you know, obviously we think of that as something that a so-called alcoholic would say, but the reality is a lot of social drinkers hate themselves too.
Absolutely.
after drink, it's just a toxic substance. Hangovers are no fun.
Yeah.
And so I kind of I grabbed onto that, drinking sucks. And it became a sort of mantra for me. Mm-hmm. And I think when they said that, I was maybe between a year and 2 years alcohol free. And I kind of ruminated on the idea, and I decided I was going to kind of fake it until I made it with that belief that drinking sucks. I'm done with it. It's worthless. Mm-hmm. And as I did that, I found, there's a saying that we tend to find what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And I just suddenly found all of these reasons to believe that that was actually true. And over time, I guess through repetition and gathering all of that reference evidence that I was looking for, it just became like a belief that was as solid as an oak, really strong. So I think I was at about 3 years away from alcohol when I wrote that book, and I'm currently over 5 years. So it's been some time. And someday I'll probably turn it into a 400-page revised and improved edition, but I don't want to fix what doesn't seem to be broken, because it's surreal to me. A lot of people have written to me and said that it's helped them a lot, and it's pretty short. It's 164 pages, but I tried to go through the process of revising my beliefs and building myself up from scratch, but also to provide as simple a possible template for change. So there's a 30-day plan at the end of that book, which closely mirrors what I did. And it does include the nutrients, but also changing your beliefs, challenging those assumptions that are false about alcohol, fixing your tribal associations, so getting rid of those worthless drinking buddies, associating with people that are good for you, and just trying to be as resourceful and authentic as you can.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean that's the book, and it's crazy. It's been a couple of years since I wrote it, because it feels like yesterday.
Wow. Well, and I went to your site, the fit-recovery.com, and you've got a lot of good information on there. I mean, really a comprehensive site with regard to your topic and the information that you're able to share with people. And are you available to people as a anything from a personal trainer to a coach to an alcohol recovery coach? What would be a way somebody might want to utilize your services personally?
Right. So I am an alcohol recovery coach, and I have a small number of clients. And about every 2 months, I take on a new group of people. And I typically keep that at 4 to 5 people, because it's not fair to people if I'm mixing up stories and not able to give my full attention. And I have a number of other things. So the podcast and some other things I'm working on. As for training. I guess I could have included this in my story. I did become a personal trainer after I quit drinking. That's what I distracted myself with. I had been an investment banker for years before that, before I quit drinking. And I was a personal trainer for a while, and it got me really comfortable working with people. So that's what I took from that. And I was able to obviously work out at any point in the day that I wanted to, but that turned into fit recovery in a sense. I started not having time to do one-on-one training. So I don't do fitness training anymore, but I do have some articles on fit-recovery.com about the exercises that helped me most. And fitness is something that I have helped people with who make it through alcohol recovery. Who make it past the point where they're still drinking and maybe they're feeling a bit better. I'm happy to design workout plans, help with diet plans and things like that. So there's the coaching. And then there's also my online course called Total Alcohol Recovery 2.0, which is a more thorough and well-organized condensing of the themes on fit-recovery.com. We have about 300 people in there, and there's a really, really supportive vibe in there. People are so nice. I mean, it's kind of crazy because I let people be anonymous, and I thought, like, what if I have a Twitter scenario where everyone's, ruining each other and you don't know who's who? But I haven't had to, censor or monitor one comment in there. Everyone is, we have people in AA, we have people outside of AA. Everyone gets along, they find common ground, and they help each other. So that's been a really cool experience as well.
Yeah. And it sounds like you create points of connection for people through even the community of your site, people that are taking the same approaches. This isn't a rabbit trail, but real briefly, I wanted to ask you about sugar. Because we had a guy, a guest, Michael Olson, a few weeks ago, who is very focused on the negative effects of sugar in our diets, period. And that is sort of his mainstay of what he has invested himself in. And how have you found, or have you found sugar to be a big factor in the nutritional aspects of your clients? Because I have people coming in, and in full disclosure, I've got a big candy bowl in my office in the middle of the coffee table because my newly sober people, especially with regard to alcohol, are just in sugar withdrawal like crazy. And to just have a conversation with them, I better have some peanut M&Ms on hand.
Right.
You know, So,
sugar is a huge subject. And, hypoglycemia is almost universal for people who are addicted to alcohol. And so they have periods of low blood sugar. Their blood sugar regulation is not well kept in check. And so because alcohol is a highly refined sugar, you find a lot of people switching right to sugar after that. Right. So, the best thing from the primitive brain's perspective, the way I understand it, is the best thing that you can get for an energy hit is alcohol because it absorbs really quickly through the stomach lining. The next best thing is sugar because it's the second easiest absorbed, and after that, so you don't typically have a craving for, a chicken breast. If you can have, the brain says, well, we'd rather have a shot of vodka, or if not that, then maybe some Jolly Ranchers. I myself was drinking 2 liters of soda a day in detox. And I had never had a sweet tooth. I couldn't figure it out. I never cared much for sweets. Before I quit drinking, when I would go to a nice restaurant, other people would get dessert and I would get the cognac or whatever. I was always drinking. I was never turning to sugar. But then I had that sweet tooth. And what really the magic bullet for me was, besides fixing my diet and having more good fats, more avocados, olive oil, salmon, things that are filling and provide longer lasting energy. But for me, it was L-glutamine, which I had initially used as a way to build muscle. But L-glutamine is an amino acid that can be converted into glucose in the brain without causing a corresponding insulin spike. So it's really unique in that. And it's helpful for people with sugar addiction. Some people need up to 10 grams of L-glutamine per day. Other people respond well to like 500 milligrams or a gram. And it's actually kind of sweet. So that the trick that I learned was to, whenever I had a sugar craving or a soda craving, to put some L-glutamine powder underneath my tongue and let it absorb sublingually through the bloodstream. And that would kind of keep me from having to go through that hypoglycemic episode. And I found that it can even help prevent panic attacks, some percentage of which are caused or at least correlated with by hypoglycemia. So that was a big thing for me. When I said that I had panic attacks, you know, up to my 6 months alcohol free, part of that was that I'd eaten several hours before, and usually I hadn't had the best meal that I'd had all week. It was maybe, you know, something with white bread or maybe fruit juice, even something sweet. And I would get that insulin spike, and several hours later, my blood sugar would go down and I would find myself trembling. And then it's like a self-fulfilling cycle, just a vicious cycle. But I found L-glutamine really helped with that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's a great thing to point out, because so many people in early sobriety that see me are, you know, like I was when I first got sober, keeping Bluebell ice cream in business. You know, I mean, it's just,
I know the feeling.
Yeah. And that took a while to get to the next place where, you know, I had to pick which hill I was going to die on. At first one was I was just at least going to not drink, but I didn't know physiologically for a long time what was going on with me and sugar. So that's an interesting component for sure. So before we let you get away, Chris, tell us about Elevation Recovery Podcast.
Right. So Elevation Recovery Podcast is a joint effort between myself and Matt Finch, who's an awesome guy. He's the founder of opiateaddictionsupport.com. And he basically, with his website, he specialized in opiate recovery using similar modalities as I discussed for alcohol recovery. So we connected a few years back. We became really good friends. We would talk on the phone. We would have these mastermind calls. And typically, he would be telling me about some like biohacking protocol that he'd come up with for supplements to help one of his clients, or even for him for, you know, elevating his mood or helping his workouts. And it could be like use green tea powder and maca powder and then have like two avocados or whatever. Uh-huh. And then I would help him design some workouts. And eventually, one of us said, we should be doing this for other people because other people might benefit. So that turned into the podcast idea. And, you know, I think he has like maybe close to 300 articles on his blog. So I would say it's probably the most important opiate recovery resource that I've ever seen. It's amazing. Wow. And I have close to 200 articles for alcohol recovery on my blog. But, you know, now we're in an age where no one really likes to sit down and read blogs as much as they like to, you know, subscribe to a podcast. So we interview some people who are our former clients or who just want to connect and share their story. But we also interview some pioneers or experts in niches. You know, neither Matt nor I am a doctor or a therapist or, you know, so we do like to interview some doctors and researchers and people who specialize in very specific subjects. And then some podcast episodes are just me and Matt, like our mastermind calls, talking about whatever we want to talk about that day. So it's been a lot of fun. And we've been inspired by you guys over here. We love your show.
Oh, well, thank you. That's awesome. Well, Chris, are you open to getting email from listeners who may want to touch base with you directly and either, you know, talk about how to engage your services or maybe just ask you some questions about some things that they're experiencing?
Absolutely. So my email is cscott, as in Chris Scott. So cscott@fit-recovery.com. And you can also find me on Instagram. I'm not there all the time. I'm trying to get better. But my Instagram is Chris Scott FR, as in Chris Scott Fit Recovery. So I try to check my messages on there every couple of days, but I guess I'm getting old. So, yeah.
Well, it's hard to keep up with everything that we're supposed to have these days. Right. You know, you're supposed to have a Facebook page and an Instagram presence, and you know, you're supposed to tweet every thought that you have in between everything else, and somewhere in there you're supposed to make a living, and you know. So anyway, yeah. Well, Chris, thank you for being with us. It's absolutely great having you with us. You've had some great information. I hope people avail themselves to your site, to your book, Drinking Sucks, which I think is a great title.
And
that's going to be great. And we would love to have you back sometime and just talk more about even maybe other specifics about health and nutrition and recovery, because what I know from my own work with folks is that the more I see and experience people in recovery, the more I realize this is a multi-pronged approach, you know, and for so long we seemed to take one lane and stay in that, and the rest of it was just sort of up for grabs. And I'm always excited when people are incorporating things like what you are with fitness, nutrition, science, the brain activity, what is going on, you know, with everything from, you know, what we're putting in our bodies to the amount of sleep we get to, you know, all that stuff. So thank you for being here with us and for sharing so much with us today.
David, thank you so much for having me. I've had a lot of fun, and you know, I'm sure you will all keep up the good work over here. And we would love to have you over at Elevation Recovery Podcast sometime. I think that might be a lot of fun.
Anytime. Just, shoot me a message and I'm there.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. We'll talk to you. All right. And Bye. Listeners, we will be right back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast in 1 minute. Don't go away. Thanks.
Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And that conversation was so much fun for me because this guy is doing some things that I am trying to get clients to do, and sometimes with some success and sometimes with minimal success. And I'm trying to get myself to do and to continue to do and see the value in. And just to hear Chris articulate how our physiology and the way we treat our bodies impacts the way our brains and our minds in turn respond, and how that impacts our cravings and our impulses. I found the whole thing to be really interesting and fun, and I'm going to be looking more at his website and gleaning more information from him as I embark on my own battle and challenges with the way I eat, the way I exercise, the regularity that I with which I do it, and honestly, the priority that I give it. Self-care, Nate and I talk about that so much, and I think today's episode particularly was such a good hands-on, tangible how to get started with self-care and treat ourselves well, be kind to ourselves, because there is a physical payoff. So I hope you found it interesting, and I hope you found it beneficial. And so, listeners, we are so grateful to have you. We appreciate your emails. Please continue to send us email at positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com. We do read them, and we are going to be dipping in again to the mailbag again soon. We love hearing how this podcast impacts you, and I want to encourage you all to just continue to share this with other people, pass it along. Our numbers, not to talk numbers, but our numbers are really growing, and we're really excited to see where what we do every week is going. And so we kind of feel like we're building a tribe and a family, and we are glad to have you as a part of it. So until next time, Rex and I are wishing you a great week. Be kind to yourselves, and we'll look forward to being with you again here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.